Nasıl? Welcome back. Glad you're feeling better. Hola, so yeah, we return to the shamatha without a sign or awareness of awareness. Some people, again, still find it somewhat elusive. The major challenge being when to know that you're doing it right. You know, and then that doubt coming in, that nagging doubt. I don't think there must be something more to it. This, where's that luminosity? I should need some sunglasses. It should be really bright, and I'm not getting much bright. It's just, whoa, whatever. So I think I need to change the word, because we certainly don't want to use words that would give misleading or kind of point in the wrong direction. It's the word, certainly it's not a wrong translation, but if it's not helpful, if it's leading away from the experience, then it's not so useful. The Tibetan word is selwa, which means clarity, means vividness, brightness, all of the above. And so when you're inverting your awareness in upon itself, or when you're simply aware of, resting in the awareness of awareness, certainly don't be looking for, expecting, anticipating something that's going to be bright. That'll just be an image. Some luminous bright. Oh, is it white? Is it yellow? Is it, what color is it? You know? What color is your mind? Don't be looking for any appearance whatsoever. So perhaps the word clarity is better. Because clarity doesn't suggest light so much. It's just, do you have a clear understanding? That doesn't necessarily mean luminous understanding. It's just clear. Is your mind clear or is it dull? Right, okay. So you're entering right into that just that sheer clarity, which again is wakefulness, it's presence, it's conscious. There it is. It's not being dead, not being fast asleep, something like that. But now to, again, try to make it as accessible as possible. Let's take the analogy, and this one I think nobody's had any really major problems with, the analogy of mindfulness of breathing, where I've plucked from the Dzogchen tradition, multiple teachers within the Dzogchen tradition, this whole method of oscillation. I just find it very, very useful. I think it's marvelously skillful means. And so I've adopted this from the Dzogchen tradition and applied it to mindfulness of breathing. I haven't seen anybody else do that, but I think the Buddha will forgive me, you know? And that is that sense of during inhalation, just during the natural inflow of the breath, a natural time to kind of reaffirm life in a way, to wake up, to attend, to arouse, to focus and concentrate. So while, and what are you attending to? Let's say you're focusing on the sensations of the nostrils. What you're attending to is a domain of experience that's completely non-conceptual. There's just nothing, there are no thoughts in those sensations, not at nostrils, not at the belly, not throughout the body, right? It's just a non-conceptual mode. And so you're just kind of sucking your awareness right into a domain where there are no thoughts. There are no thoughts lingering at the tip of your nose, right? So it's going right into something non-conceptual. So it would be like, for example, if I had just a really tasty piece of this Belgian chocolate. And I said, Katinka, just here's one piece. But Katinka, just try this. It's really, really good. And just pops it in. And let's imagine she's not a chemist. She's not a connoisseur of chocolate. She just likes chocolate. When it pops into the mouth, she's gone non-conceptual. Bliss, luminosity, all three there. That's as good as you say. It just goes right into the taste, and there's nothing to think about. If you do, you're just filtering. You're contaminating. You're veiling the experience of chocolate. What are you doing that for? If you want to think about chocolate, I'll keep it. I'll keep the chocolate. You think about chocolate, and I'll eat the chocolate. You know, you can just think about it. Or you can read a chocolate menu if you like. But I'm going to eat the chocolate because that's non-conceptual, and it's much better than any thought about chocolate. Right? So in a similar way, in mindfulness of breathing, when you're just focusing in on the sensations of the breath, you're just going into something that's just straight perceiving it. There's nothing to think about, right? But then when you release, the breath flows out, then what do? Then now's the time to relax, relax. Gently sustain the flow of attention here, but in an ambience, a flow of just like that, releasing, releasing, releasing. And very importantly, as I'm sure you've heard this now 10 or 20 times, as you're breathing out, whatever thoughts come up, just release them. It's not that much effort. If, again, Katinka was, if there was a rope between us, we're doing tug of war. She's on one side. She's a pretty big gal. She could beat me, you know, but so she's pulling on the rope and I'm pulling on the rope. Well, it would take a lot of effort to pull over. Maybe I'm bigger. I'm certainly heavier. So maybe I could win just because I'm heavier and I'm pulling. That would take a lot of effort, right? But it would take much less effort as she's pulling on me. It would take a little bit of effort, but not as much. Go ahead and pull. That's what happens to my thought. She did that so well. We should get that videotape. That's what happens to the thought. You know, it took me a little bit of effort because I've gotten into a spasm here. She's tugging, I'm tugging, she's tugging, I'm tugging. So if I just stay fixated, then I'm just wearing myself out, you know, like that. But if I give a little bit of effort, then, boop, she goes, and she falls. You notice she didn't fall into me. She fell away from me. Right. And that's it. So as you're breathing out, we got this tug of war. So many of you are saying, oh, the thoughts catch me. They drag me. They captivate me. They keep on dragging me, dragging me. Hey, there is a solution. Let go. It's not that much effort. It's much more effort to struggle with them. You can imagine this should be a real struggle, right? But so much less struggle. Just let them go. So you're either drawing the thoughts in, drawing your awareness into a non-conceptual space with some effort, or you're releasing the thoughts entirely into non-conceptual space, but either way, they don't get in. Okay? So only as a thought experiment, with no harm intended to any sentient being, imagine a fan. Imagine you got mosquitoes all over the room, right? And you got a fan. And the fans suck and they blow, right? That's how fans work. And so either the mosquitoes are being sucked into the fan, which they get obliterated, or they're blown away from the fan. But fans are just not mosquito friendly. Any side of the fan is just not a friendly place for mosquitoes. You know, it's either sucked in and they get gone, or they're just blown away. So either suck the thoughts into the fan of your awareness, into a non-conceptual space, as you're breathing in, then they have no chance. Because you're, no, I'm sorry, no time. Oh, now I'm breathing out. Bye-bye. Sorry, no time. Bye. They're kind of waiting. When is my turn? When is my turn? You're either pushing me out this way or blowing me away this way. They can't get in. You know? So, it's not that hard. That's mindfulness of breathing. Right? It really should be non-conceptual. And now taking that as an analogy, since I drew the oscillation from the Dzogchen tradition into mindfulness of breathing, and I find it helpful, then let's come back to awareness of awareness. First of all, there is just that settling. And by the way, I'm talking about it now, so when I give the guided meditation, I will hardly need to speak at all. But there's just that settling of, as Padmasambhava says, resting your awareness evenly in space, not attending to anything, not deliberately attending to anything, and very importantly, even including the space of the mind. There's a time to look at the space of the mind, settling the mind in its natural state. When there are no thoughts, during the intervals between thoughts, go ahead, gaze at the mind. Gaze at it more closely with your temporal vividness, your qualitative vividness. So there's a time to attend to the space of the mind. It's in settling the mind in its natural state. But when practicing shamatha with no sign, that means we're not attending to any of the so-called signs of the five physical senses, not any of the signs of the activities of the mind, thoughts, images, and so forth, not even the sign of the space of the mind. We're not attending to any object at all. So you just rest there, and all you are is being present. So really, it's 100% being, 0% doing. Because you've not started your shamatha yet. Right? Shamatha entails some doing. Not much, but a little bit. But before, this is what Padmasambhava is getting at. It's rebooting. I'm coming back to that analogy. It's a pretty darn good one. Rebooting, restarting your computer. And that is, here we are throughout the course of the day, we're always engaging with something. Looking at our thoughts, looking at the food, looking at the scenery, talking to somebody, writing a journal, whatever, it's always going out, out, out. And then here he just says, okay, now reboot, just stop everything. Just restart, reboot, stop everything you're doing. Everything. And don't fall asleep. You know? And then, and when you suddenly lose interest in all appearances to the mind, every single one, all appearances to any of the six senses, just, you just checked out, no interest whatsoever. There's just one thing left that is obvious. if you're really not attending to, deliberately giving your attention to any object of the mind, there's just one thing left that really intrudes into your experience. What would that be? Yeah. Even if you're not aware of that, you're still aware. And that, now that all the noises die down, and the better your samadhi, the better the noise dies down, then when there's no interest there, then there's just one thing left. Ah, I'm still aware. Even without attending to that or that, even without attending to any sign, awareness is still there. Oh, let's be aware of that. So, in this practice, to make it easy, even if you've struggled with it until now, I hope in this session, you'll get it. It's not that hard. And that is, first of all, just reboot, restart, don't do anything, pure being, just be present, without distraction, without grasping, be present. Until, and again, my sense of it, it's as if, it's only a metaphor, the sun is arising from behind your back. Something dawns on you. And it's not light, it's not a color, it's not an image, it's just like, whoa. Wow. Consciousness. That's it. Okay. Just stay right there. Whoa. Wow. Oh. Just stay there, right? Get it. Okay, this is doing it right. It's something so simple, it was closer than you thought. You're looking for luminosity, you're looking for something special. Where's the bliss? Where's this? Where's that? And it's prior to all of those. And recognize, but I already knew this. Yeah, that was the whole point. Shave off all your other knowing and stay with what's left. When you've shaved off all your other knowing of everything else, what's left? The knowing of knowing. And then just rest there. So it's not acquiring some new knowledge. It's shaving off all the others and leaving that which is essential. And the only way you lose this would be to fall asleep and slip into the substrate. Then you don't know anything. Right? So just rest there. And then, at your leisure, then set up the oscillation. And that is just then intensify. So I'll take Katinka's left knee as an example. I'm gazing at it. So there it is. I'm gazing at it. And now, I am really taking an interest. I think I'm going to know everything there is to be known about that knee that can be gotten visually. Of course, with a covering. That's all I really want to know. But it's that scrutiny, it's that heightened interest. That sort of, so when we speak of withdrawing the attention, a lot of you wonder, where am I withdrawing it from and where am I going to? Behind my eyebrows, throat, right nipple, you know, where am I supposed to go? You know, you're not going anywhere. It's just a heightened interest. It's just like increasing the wattage where you already were, right? Like, oh, boom. As Padmasambhava says, arouse, focus, concentrate. Hey, get to it. Ten. You know, right into awareness. And that takes some effort. But it's just going, it's intensifying your interest and your focus on what you already knew. The awareness of being aware. And then at your leisure, then release. But you're not going anywhere. You're just utterly relaxing. And here's the point. In the early phases of the practice, this will be enough. When you invert, invert just to the point that you know being aware. You know awareness. Just know that. And then when you're releasing, just know no thought. Just know no thought. That is, as you're releasing, whatever thought comes up, gone. No interest. Any more than the fan has an interest in the mosquitoes. It just, they're gone. Right? And so as you're releasing, just release into no thought. Whatever thought comes up, just release it. Into an open expanse, gently sustaining the thread of knowing of knowing. And then concentrate. Release into no thought. And know that there is no thought. Don't just go spacing out, blank-minded. When you're deep asleep, there's no thought, but you don't know there's no thought. But I know there's no elephant in the room. I looked around, there's an elephant, I'd see it. No elephant. So you're seeing that something isn't there. You're knowing something. And as you're releasing, release into knowing there's no thought. There is no thought and know there's no thought. In other words, it's imperative to maintain the flow of knowing. You're either knowing, being aware, or you're knowing no object, very specifically, no thought object. So it's an ongoing flowing, a knowing of vacuity, of no object, a knowing of awareness, a knowing of vacuity, a knowing of awareness, an ongoing flow of knowing. Now, we speak of oscillation, but really we're not moving anywhere. So as you get the hang of it, of just being aware of the sheer clarity, clearly knowing the experience of knowing, entering into clarity, then releasing into emptiness, and then inverting into clarity, and releasing into emptiness, then when you get the hang of it, then you can just rest in the center, neither going out nor going in, and you're simultaneously clear and empty. You're aware simultaneously of clarity and emptiness. That's enough. And as Shapkar Rinpoche says in The Flight of Garuda, if you just rest in that immediate experience of clarity and emptiness, that's called Dzogchen. Dzogchen meditation. Not bad. Okay? So, as I've said so many times, of course, this practice is right on the cusp of Dzogchen, but I'm teaching it in this more modest way that Padmasambhava teaches it, as simply shamatha without a sign. Okay? So there's that. And I got a couple of little notes. Oh yeah. Big topic. I try to deal with it concisely, but it's very important. I've referred to it before. The situation that many people face, not especially in the West or around, you know, the West 360 degrees around the globe, in modern cities and so forth, but also you find in India and Dharamsala, Nepal and so forth, this sense of just what I call doing a little bit of this and a little bit of that kind of approach to Dharma. Why don't we do a little bit of Turkey practice? Why don't we do some Dushan practice? Oh, we finished with that. Good. Now let's do Vajrasattva. That's cool. Now let's do Stygian narration practice. Let's go back and do some of this. Oh, hey, they're giving this initiation. Let's get that one. Oh, another initiation. Let's do that one. Let's do a little bit of the Dharma protector. Hey, some dakini would be good. A little side dish of dakini, always good. You know, and so this kind of a little bit of this, a little bit of that approach. And then your whole life passes as kind of like coming in and smorgasbording on Dharma for the whole time. But in the midst of that, there really isn't any path at all. It's just helter-skelter, right? And so what is the benefit of that? There is benefit. You get a whole bunch of mental imprints. Whole bunch of mental imprints. And that's good. That's good. It's good to do that, even better to practice Dharma. As Dom Dhamma said, there is such a thing as a path. And this is not something, you know, this is the Galupa tradition. It's not that. It's the Buddha. The Buddha didn't go off and leave the palace to practice Dharma. Did he? Just to go off and practice Dharma? He could have stayed home and practiced Dharma. You know? He didn't even need to cook for himself. Everything taken care of. He went off to seek liberation. He found it, and he spent the rest of his teaching showing a path. Here is the reality of suffering, its source, liberation, and the path to it. And so the path, I mean, that's what really the whole teachings of the Buddha are all about. But in the midst of the teachings of the Buddha, as we find recorded in the Theravada tradition, the Mahayana tradition, there is this recurrent refrain. It comes up again and again. And that is over the course of time, from the time of the Buddha, and then 500 years later, another 500 years later, another 500 years. Man, it's crapola after 500 years. You know, it's like so degenerate, so tanked. And so now 2,500 years after we finished 2,500 years, now we're into the next 500 years after that one. You know. So the whole theme of the degeneration of Dharma, the degeneration of the whole world, everything going down the toilet. But Buddha Dharma also just degenerating, kind of just slip like a dinosaur slipping into a tar pit, you know, just blah, 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 blah. And so that's one way of viewing reality, one way of viewing history, is that now we're after, we've post the 2500 year period, 5 times 500. Man, it got really sucky. And there are a number of deepers nowadays, I've heard them, I'm not making this up, who say, time of realization is finished. It's too degenerate. People won't gain realization nowadays. Shamatha, nobody's going to teach shamatha. It's too, your minds are too coarse, shamatha is too subtle, you won't do it even if you try, you won't succeed. Don't bother. Now is the time, just try to keep your precepts, don't screw up too badly. Learn dharma, teach dharma, and die. With good imprints. You know, get a lot of good imprints. And meanwhile, we'll teach you a little bit of this and a little bit of that, so you can have a nice sprinkling of esoteric practices and basic practices and this and this and this. So meditate on 100 deities, don't gain realization of evil, either any one of them, but at least you got a whole bunch of really good imprints. And so there are a number of teachers, East and West, who are really singing that song. And there's a pretty powerful image, and I think it actually is based in reality. I would imagine most of you have seen the movie Titanic, when it's really clear it's sinking, and it's really clear they don't have enough lifeboats. You're a member of the little orchestra? How can you forget? If you saw the movie, you can't forget the orchestra. They all know they're going to die, because they're men and they have to give women and children first, so they're being gentlemen. They're showing incredibly good, stiff upper lip English gentlemanness. It's really classic. It was a class act. So, and I think it really occurred. So there's no sarcasm here. But they're playing the music till people feel a little bit better as they're facing death and as the whole thing goes down. And when it's right going down, it was beautifully done in the movie. They just turned to each other with such grace, such poise, and said something like, "It's been an honor." It was very touching. So people who teach nowadays, teach Dharma, Buddha Dharma nowadays, with a sense that it's really hopeless. But let's play on. They really strike me as like the orchestra. You know? They really do. I think it's this close analogy. Make people feel better as the ship sinks and we say goodbye, bye-bye to Dharma, Buddha Dharma. It's very sweet, but incredibly sad. Especially sad when we consider that it took 2,500 years for the Buddha Dharma to become global. That's a long time to wait. Asia is a big country, big continent. But there is North and South America, and Europe, and Africa, and Australia. Not to mention New Zealand. And so for Buddha Dharma, finally, when it goes supernova, and it kind of the light of the Buddha Dharma finally reaches all the way around the world, for it to come out with a little sign saying dead on arrival is kind of anticlimactic. Like, couldn't you have come out a little bit earlier when you still had a breath of life in you and not just have said, "I'm dead"? Everybody. It's really kind of bummer. So is that the only way to look at what's happening to the Buddha Dharma in the modern world? I think I might have mentioned earlier on, quite a few years back, early in the early 70s, some European fellow, I didn't know him well, knew him a little bit, he had a personal interview with the Dalai Lama, and he raised this issue. He said, these are really degenerate times. He was right. You don't need to tell the Tibetans it's a degenerate time. They just had genocide. They just had been eviscerated and just totaled by this incredibly brutal communist regime. So he didn't need to tell them anything about degeneration. They had seen it with their own eyes. And in China and in Mongolia and in Laos and Cambodia, North Korea and Vietnam, everywhere the communists were there, just lining up Buddhists, mowing them down. So that was the worst century in all of history for the Buddha Dharma, was the 20th century. Don't need to be told about degeneration. So this European was telling, this young European man was basically lamenting in his interview with His Holiness, "It's so degenerate now, times must be past that anybody can gain any deep realization. Kind of hopeless." And His Holiness' response was, "You're very right. This is a very degenerate time." It's true. Not debatable. But if you practice like Milarepa, even now, you'll achieve like Milarepa, even now. So, yes, go ahead and make the broad generalizations. But if somebody has that integrity, that ethics, and bear in mind, he had a pretty awful past, pretty evil past, but he purified himself from it with utmost integrity, discipline, single-pointed, absolute dedication to practice, then I achieve the highest realization. So I would rather, absolutely rather, die trying to find the path and proceed along it and spend my whole life never getting there than to give up early on and then be realistic and not get there. Any day. Any day. I'd much rather fail at doing something marvelously worthwhile than succeed at being hopeless. Because the hopelessness, and this holiness is also common. Here's a man, again, bear in mind that for more than for 60 years now, he's been doing absolutely everything in his power to try to restore human rights, some basic decency, preservation of culture in his homeland. One would say overall, no sign of success. But in the light of that, he said, oh, not too long ago, but it comes up again and again, if you lose hope, then it's hopeless. All you have to do is lose hope, then the situation is hopeless, because you've lost hope. You have made it so because you become hopeless. So truth will prevail. And there he is at the age of 76, traveling all over the world, spreading a message of love, of peace, of wisdom, with no hatred for anyone, and never ever giving up. So that's what I feel about Tibet. And its culture, its people. Never give up. Not as long as there's one Tibetan alive. Don't give up. It's too valuable, too precious. And likewise, the notion of the path. That is not just practicing a bunch of Dharma and getting good imprints. There's actually a path in this lifetime. Even if we don't complete it in this lifetime, we can set out in a direction. And the term in Tibetan is Yang Dape Lam. It's not talking about pure Dharma. I get sick of hearing that term, frankly. So many people think they have the pure Dharma. Oh, this is pure Gelupa. Oh, this is pure Nyingma. We don't mess with those other new schools. This is pure Nyingma. This is pure Theravada. This is the pure teaching of the Buddha. This is just Pali Canon. This is pure, all the gobbledygook is shaved off. This is pure Zen. Pure, pure, pure. Give me a break. Give me a break. You know, give me a break. This is just bullshit. Sometimes that word is just perfect. This is bullshit. You know? If a person has diabetes, and you say, this is pure medicine by diabetes, and it doesn't work, who? You can finish that sentence yourself. Whereas if a person has diabetes, and you give medicine, and it heals them, then it doesn't matter whether it's pure, it doesn't matter whether it's made out of processed dog manure. It doesn't matter if it works. That's all that matters. If you have diabetes and then you don't, you say, thank you for the medicine. I don't know what was in it, but it was really good. That worked. That was authentic medicine for diabetes. That's all that matters. Yang Dape Lam. An authentic path. So are there still teachers nowadays in multiple traditions, no sectarian implied or stated, are there teachers now who are teaching or presenting, revealing an authentic path to liberating us, that we can set out on the cruise, set out on the expedition in this lifetime to truly be liberated by a step-by-step path, just as an ocean voyage, you first go the first 10 kilometers and then the next 100 kilometers. You don't just sporadically try a little bit this all over the ocean. You have a path. Likewise, you want to cross a continent, like the Lewis and Clark expedition. They went from here to here to here. They made it to the Pacific Ocean. You know, but there was a path. That is what Buddha Dharma is about. So let's not join the orchestra. Not yet. And within the path is something so easily overlooked, smudged, marginalized, or just not understood. And that is, we have this marvelous array of practices in all traditions. What I'm saying is really utterly non-sectarian. But there are these marvelous practices, wisdom practices, Vajrayana practices, Dzogchen Mahamudra, Chan practices, Theravada practices, so many profound practices that are really explicitly designed to liberate. So basically in the genre of Vipassana, whether it's Vipassana brought into Vajrayana, Vipassana brought into Dzogchen, Mahamudra, into the Chan tradition, into Soto Zen, Rinzai Zen, whatever it may be, or into Vipassana in the Theravada tradition, So this wide array of incredibly rich, diverse, and incredibly profound practices, all designed to liberate the mind irreversibly from its afflictive tendencies and from all obscurations that veil, that obscure our own Buddha nature. So there's a wide variety of them. And then as the Tibetan aphorism goes, there are many profound practices, but few profound practitioners. So what is it that makes you a profound practitioner? Is it IQ? Is it just how much faith you have? How long you spend in a retreat? How great your teacher is? How famous your teacher is? Well, according to multiple traditions, Theravada tradition, Indian Mahayana tradition, and all schools of Tibetan Buddhism, in order for these wisdom practices, in the Sutrayana, the Vajrayana, Dzogchen Mahamudra, in order for them to be fully effective, to do what they're designed to do, you have to have a serviceable mind. It's just that simple. The mind, that's why there's ethics at the foundation, and then samadhi, and then all the wisdom practices, all of them without exception. Right? That's why there are five perfections prior to the wisdom. And the fifth one is samadhi. It's jhana, it's meditation. You skip that one, can you go directly and say, well, I don't really care about that. That's, I just want the wisdom ones. Yeah. You can. You can. And it really struck me, this is like, instead of going to the Louvre in Paris and seeing the Mona Lisa for yourself, which I have seen, rather impressive painting. Instead of doing that, say, oh, never mind. That's too much trouble. Fax me a copy. Fax me a color copy. Scan it and fax it to me. I'll see it. And somebody scans it, sends you email. Yep, that's a pretty picture. That's a pretty picture. I'm going to print it. I got the Mona Lisa. What other classics do you got? Got some Van Gogh? Fax me. I'm going to get a whole collection here. The Rembrandt, the Van Gogh, Picasso. I'm going to have a whole art collection here. All faxes. And they're cheap. They're really, really cheap. You don't need any renunciation to speak of. You don't need bodhicitta. You just need a good fax machine. And a printer. So all the wisdom practices without shamatha, they're faxes. They look good. They bring about some transformation, some pleasure. Good. But there's really good reason to believe that none of them will work, not to full capacity, without the shamatha. And the Buddha indicated this. This is not a sectarian deal. The Buddha said, and you saw it, quoted verbatim in the Nikayas, if your mind is not free of the five obscurations, sensual craving, right? Ill will, laxity and dullness, excitation and remorse, and uncertainty, you can consider yourself bound, enslaved, ill, and lost on a desert track. In other words, you are one sad puppy, and you are not ready for Vipassana. Give me a break. Your mind doesn't even work. How do you take this broken down, dysfunctional mind and think you're going to use it to liberate it from all mental affliction? It's not reasonable. And so it's the Buddha himself, it's Tsongkhapa, it's Padmasambhava, Duchom Lingpa, Asanga, Nagarjuna, Chandakirti, Buddha Gosa. They all do seem to have come to a certain consensus there. And it's amazing that there's so much consensus that it's not that important. So, I wanted to share with you that point, now maybe for the last time. And assure you that there are still teachers who are passing on authentic path. There are really two ways for that to be done. The best way, is to find a person who's gained direct, immediate, and full realization of whatever you're seeking, whether it's bodhicitta, realization of emptiness, rikpa, whatever it may be. That's the best. So the transmission is just right from a person who has it completely. The master chef. Direct, boom, from that person's realization to you. That's the best. That's absolutely best. Right? If you don't have access to such an extraordinarily accomplished yogi, then the next best, and it's still really, it's feasible, it's still workable, is to find someone who's received lineage from such a being. And whether it's one step removed, two step removed, however much step removed, just to have that confidence that each step in the transmission remains not pure, authentic. Pure, if you want pure, turn on the tape recorder. Get a person like Dingo Kenzo Rinpoche, or Ling Rinpoche, or one of the other great beings from the past. If you want pure, turn on the tape recorder. Just play the tape recorder and they say, here's the pure teaching. And just play the tape recorder. That's pure. I mean, it's exactly what he said. Right? That's good. That's pure. Will that be effective? It might be. Who can say? But the whole idea of Nyingyu is that somebody's listening. Tape recorders don't listen. It's an absolutely mindless reproduction, right? But the Nyingyu, the oral lineage, is a disciple hearing from the master and passing on to the next. And so each time it is contemporary. You're not just hearing a tape recorder. You're not just getting a replay of teachings given 100 years, 500 years, 2,500 years ago, thinking somehow the older it is, the more pure it is. No, the older it is, the older it is. Doesn't mean pure. Right? The only question, as with the diabetes example, is does it work or not? And if the source is authentic, if the source, such as a Dujum Lingba, such as a Padmasambhava, such as a Tsongkhapa, and others more recent, if the source has that tremendous integrity, direct realization, and it's passed on whether one generation or 10 generations, it's passed on with authenticity, then that's enough. And even if your teacher is not enlightened, if it's passing on teachings that are authentic from an enlightened person, that's enough. That's not a speculation. That's been demonstrated many, many times. So on that note, claiming absolutely nothing with respect to myself, waste of time to talk about it at all, frankly, I'd like now to share with you just one more passage from the Vajra Essence to draw a distinction that if one fails to make it, one can waste an enormous amount of time, and if one makes it, it can save you an enormous amount of time. Okay? So I won't just read it. If I feel here and there it might be helpful to make a comment, I will try to bring it into the 21st century, since this was revealed in the 1860s. But it is authentic, and it's from a source that was enlightened. So here's what Dujum Lingba says. That is what he passed on, what he shared. From the primordial Buddha, Samatabhadra, manifesting as Padmasambhava in this pure vision. And it's in a whole phase of the text, the Vajra Essence, where he's taking us his scalpel and saying, you must distinguish this from that. If you don't, you can waste a lot of time. Okay? So here's the distinction he draws. The distinction between mind, coarse mind, dualistic mind, the mind that we're all familiar with, that psychologists study, that we're all familiar with, mind and rikpa, pristine awareness. What's the difference? Well, everybody here could say something. Here's what Dujun Lingma has to say. If you do not know how to distinguish between the mind and pristine awareness, or rikpa, you will confuse the mind for pristine awareness, which will unfortunately lead to obstacles to achieving the state of liberation. So know how to distinguish them. As for the mind, and I was going to give three different categories. As for the mind, there is, first of all, the deluded mind that clings to appearances. That's going to make me happy. That's why I'm unhappy. And the finger goes out. There's the deluded mind. It's crazy. It's not getting it. The deluded mind that clings to appearances. The mind that seeks the path by way of negation and affirmation. Do this, don't do that. Seeking the path. And then finally, the mind that takes consciousness as the path. Have I got your interest? I'm really interested myself. Let's see what he says. So first of all, he's going to unpack each of these. The deluded mind that clings to appearances is the ordinary mind of sentient beings who do not seek the path and do not see an entrance to the authentic path. In other words, they're just getting by. Right? We've all done that. Been there, done that. That's a deluded mind. Secondly, the mind that seeks the path is said to take the mind as the path. So you know what that is. That's his synonym for settling the mind in its natural state. Takes the mind as the path. For in this case, the mind observes the mind. Thoughts are observed with a conceptual mind. In terms of actual practice, you don't immediately slip into non-conceptuality, right? And one seeks the path of merely arousing pleasure and pain through intellectual fabrications and the acceptance and rejection of virtue and vice. So embedding the settling the mind practice in the context of a broader practice, then a lot of thoughts are aroused, arousing pleasure, arousing pain, meditating on impermanence, death, reality of suffering, meditating on bodhicitta, guru yoga, and so forth, arousing, and then acceptance of virtue, rejection of vice. So there's somebody who's actually doing something, taking the mind as a path, seeking to transform it, as well as simply observing it. So a medley of practices, like many of us have been doing for the last 6 weeks, taking the mind as a path. Then, as for the mind that takes consciousness as the path, the experience of unceasing ordinary consciousness, which is the ground of the mind. Unceasing ordinary consciousness, which is the ground of the mind. What could that be? Is that like only one right answer? The unceasing ordinary consciousness, which is the ground of the mind. Substrate consciousness, yeah. Couldn't be anything else. Oh, lasso. For the mind that takes consciousness as the path, the experience of unceasing ordinary consciousness, which is the ground of the mind, is not the realization of the view. So in case you thought he was referring to Rigpa, now he says it's not. That's not right. That's not what he's referring to. He says it. That is not the realization of the view by means, in this context, he means the Dzogchen view. And the Dzogchen view is viewing reality from the perspective of Rigpa. It's nothing more, nothing less than that. As a result of such practice, it sounds like awareness of awareness, the experience of unceasing ordinary consciousness. As a result of such practice, outer appearances are reduced to an ethically neutral state. They vanish into substrate. And since those appearances are taken to be real, reification is not counteracted. In other words, all you're doing is withdrawing your awareness from appearances, so the screen goes blank. But because you've gained no insight into the nature of the appearances, then the tendency to reify them into objective, intrinsically existent objects has not even been touched. You've just avoided the problem. You've just turned off the juice. So it goes dormant, right? As you happily go into your awareness, maybe you experience bliss, luminosity, and non-conceptuality. But it's giving you no insight into the actual nature of appearances. You've simply withdrawn from them. That was very familiar practice at the time of the Buddha. So reification is not counteracted. Inwardly, your own body appears to be ethically neutral. So the fixation of reifying the body is not counteracted. Well, your body appears to be ethically neutral until you don't have any experience of the body, in which case your awareness withdraws from the body. But again, it's gained no insight into the body at all. So all the tendency of reification has not even been touched. That's why he says elsewhere in the text, just achieving shamatha doesn't take you one step closer to achieving liberation. By itself, it's not a path at all. It's a jacuzzi. Okay? Very pleasant jacuzzi. And since both outer and inner appearances are taken to be ethically neutral and substantially existent, you do not transcend the mind. So that too is called the mind. So even substrate consciousness, it's called the mind. It's called subtle mind. That's it. It's just called subtle mind, but it's still totally embedded in, shrouded by samsara. Even if that were called, so now let's imagine you've just practiced awareness of awareness, and you've realized substrate consciousness, and you're enjoying it. And you may want to, do it as so prevalent nowadays, give your experience some very elegant status. Within this marvelous array of terminology, of elegant terminology in Tibetan Buddhism. Even if that were called pristine awareness, so you experience the substrate consciousness and say, oh, Rigpa! Even if that were called pristine awareness, like giving a boy's name to an unborn fetus, The characteristic of ascertaining pristine awareness in itself would not have been realized. Giving a boy's name to an unborn fetus doesn't make any sense because it could be a boy or a girl. So it's premature. That's what he's really saying, just premature. It could be a girl. It could be a hermaphrodite. It could be, who knows, a mutant. But it's not pristine awareness. Don't jump the gun. Don't go there too fast. Premature. So, unawareness. Unawareness, ma-rigpa, not pristine awareness, unawareness, is failing to recognize samsara and nirvana as great emptiness. And the terms awareness and unawareness are known conventionally by way of their respective functions. So simply resting in the substrate consciousness is still, has not transcended ma-rigpa, not rigpa. Right? That which is attending to is of the very nature of ma-rigpa, not knowing. And so you know something, you know bliss, luminosity, and non-conceptuality, but you know the nature of samsara and or nirvana. No. Have you gained any glimmering into the empty nature of samsara and nirvana? No. Therefore you don't know. Therefore you're unaware. Therefore you're still in mind and you're not in rigpa. Because rigpa is aware. Rigpa gets it. Gets it big time. So that's mind. That's mind. Welcome to mind. It's taking mind as the path to get to the substrate consciousness. And then, for that little phase of the practice, he describes it so clearly, taking mind as the path, you start from day one, looking at, whoa, there's a lot of junk in there. You know, first day, whoa, or all the cockroaches vanish as soon as I look at them. No matter what, there it is, your day one. You just hopped aboard the Taking the Mind Express. Taking the Mind as the Path Express. You just hopped aboard, right? And then there's the end of the line. When taking the mind as the path has come to the end of the line and it doesn't go any further. What's its terminus? When do you have to get off? Either stay in the train and just smoke cigars for the rest of your life, or you get off the train and get on another train. What's the terminus? Shamatha, yeah. Substrate consciousness. Once you've taken the mind as a path and you get to substrate consciousness, the train doesn't go any further. It stopped. Everybody got off the train. Or they've fallen asleep on the train. But it's not going anywhere. So if you want to go someplace and continue on a path, then, and Dujum Lingbas, in his strategy, then Chunyi Lamdukirwa. Then you take Dhammata, ultimate reality, emptiness. You take that as your path. Go to Vipassana. And then it's Rigpa. And then it's Buddhahood. It's just four trains. Olasu. So there's his description of taking the mind its path and where it gets you. Still in mind. Subtle mind, but still mind. But now in contrast to that, now pristine awareness. Pristine awareness first establishes everything included in the phenomenal world of samsara and nirvana as emptiness. So on the path, this is Chunyi Lamdukirwa. This is taking Dhammata as the path. Now that you've gotten to the end of the line of taking the mind as the path, here's your task. Realize the emptiness of everything in existence, all realms of existence, and nirvana. Recognize nirvana is also empty. All appearances are empty. Realize it all. Don't leave anything out. Don't leave any crumbs on the table. Don't leave anything untouched. And that's not by withdrawing, that's by expedition. Venturing forth and gaining insight into the empty nature of all phenomena in samsara and nirvana. That's your first task. If you skip that one, then you're not going anywhere. It first establishes everything included in the phenomenal world of samsara and nirvana as emptiness. And then he gives analogies. The reflections of the planets and stars in the ocean have no existence apart from the ocean. Yet they are of the same nature as the play of the ocean. Those reflections only exist apart from the ocean, and yet they are simply the play. They are the effulgence, the display of the ocean. Likewise, rainbows in the sky have no existence apart from the sky. Yet those appearances are of the same nature as the play of the sky. Play means display, effulgence, manifestation. In the same manner, so he gave two analogies, in the same manner, pristine awareness is actualized by correctly recognizing that things appear even though nothing exists from the side of appearances, and that all appearances of the animate and inanimate world have no existence apart from the ground, Sukhatagarbha. Sukhatagarbha, Buddha nature. Yet those appearances are of the same nature as the play of the ground, Sukhatagarbha. So it's not only that all phenomena are empty of inherent nature, but all appearances, samsara and nirvana equally, have no existence apart from Rigpa, and they are nothing other than displays of Rigpa. So it's a loaded realization. It's not simply realizing they're empty of inherent nature. It is realizing, by way of that realization, that all appearances are nothing other than your own appearances. And your own appearances are appearances of your own Rigpa. That's pristine awareness. Like the dawn breaking in the sky, once you've ascertained this, once you've ascertained Rigpa, like the dawn breaking in the sky without needing to meditate, now there's nothing to meditate on. There's no place to direct your attention. Like the dawn breaking in the sky without needing to meditate, you comprehend samsara and nirvana as being totally subsumed within great enlightenment. There's nothing outside of Buddha mind. Never has been, never will be. Without need of examination, there is self-awareness without grasping. That the whole of samsara and nirvana is like the reflections of the planets and stars in the ocean. Without need of modification, there is natural liberation in the absolute space of the ground. The great purity and equality of samsara and nirvana. Without need of objectification, there is a spacious dissolution into the great expanse with no object, obstruction, or intentionality. In this way, you experience and gain mastery over the inexhaustible ornamental wheels of the body, speech, mind, noble qualities, and enlightened activities of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas of the three times. I won't unpack that piece by piece, but with no modification, you fully realize, embody, and experience all the qualities of enlightenment. Ultimately, simply by identifying the Dharmakaya, the pristine awareness that is present as the ground of being, you gain power over the life force of samsara and nirvana. Now, gain power is wong, which is the same word as empowerment, going for Chenrezig empowerment, Kalachakra empowerment, same word. This is very interesting what's coming up. I'm going to read it again, but it's the same word. You gain power, you gain empowerment. Let's read it again. Ultimately, simply by identifying the Dharmakaya, the pristine awareness that is present as the ground of being, you gain power over the life force of samsara and nirvana. This is not talking about receiving empowerment through such things as water and symbolic pictures that are used as methods to awaken the mind. Rather, you know you have obtained the empowerments of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and the oral transmissions of all the writings that emerge from the primordial consciousness of pristine awareness. Thus, you have already simultaneously obtained all empowerments and oral transmissions. Therefore, recognize the importance of not mistaking the mind for pristine awareness. So all empowerments in one, with no ritual, no vases, no look at this, look at that, eat this, drink that, imagine this, put on this string. You get empowered by Dharmakaya, and you get all the empowerments in one. Okay, I wanted to share that with you. I hope you find it as meaningful as I did. Let's practice. And I'll get this to this question tomorrow. following in the tradition of Padmasambhava, let's settle the body, speech, and mind in their natural state. Let your eyes be open, evenly resting in the space in front of you, taking nothing as an object, simply being present without distraction, without grasping, unmoving. And continue being present with no object until it dawns on you that something's happening. And we give it the name awareness. And you already knew it was there. Now just rest in that knowing of being aware. Then, like breathing in and breathing out, arouse, focus, concentrate your awareness, single-pointedly in on that experience of being aware. A totally non-conceptual probe. Then release your awareness into the non-conceptual space. An open expanse. Invert and release at your own pace, your own rhythm. as you invert your awareness, invert more deeply. You have a sense of having been meditating for the last several minutes. Have a sense of being the one who is withdrawing and releasing your awareness, being the agent, the meditator, the person in control. As you invert your awareness, invert it right in upon that within which is inverting and releasing the awareness. Inspect closely. See what comes to mind. Invert and release as before. As you invert your awareness in upon the agent, see what comes to mind. Don't say nothing comes to mind. It's not true. What comes to mind when you invert your awareness in upon the agent? What is the nature of this appearance? Is it truly an agent? Or is it just an empty appearance? A mirage? As you invert your awareness, invert deeply enough, sharply enough, that your probe delivers insight, knowledge, some certainty. In the not seeing of any autonomous agent in here, let there be a direct perception of the absence of a real agent in here. No real subject. Release your awareness into non-objectivity, no object. Invert your awareness into non-subjectivity, no subject. sustaining throughout the awareness of being aware. Then release the oscillation. Let your awareness come to settle, come to rest, right where it is. Already empty of subject and object, already clear, and knowing. And rest in that clear knowing. Acha. Still have a bit of time. Okay, we have time for one question. Olaso. This is from Kay. In this text, the union of the Gelupa and Gagyu tradition of Mahamudra, Benjen Losanchoki Yenzen wrote of seeking to meditate on the basis of the view and seeking the view on the basis of meditation. Could you please speak about the view and these methods? So, yeah. Two approaches. Meditate on the basis of view and seeking the view on the basis of meditation. Quite interesting to say this. He's speaking as one of the greatest followers of Tsongkhapa ever since the time of Tsongkhapa. Extraordinary master, realization, great scholar, so great that he was chosen to be the tutor of the fifth Dalai Lama. You gotta be good. You gotta be good. And so this is his text on Mahamudra, which of course, Mahamudra being so adjacent to Dzogchen. In fact, according to one man who was actually like a secondary tutor at Senshap for the fifth Dalai Lama. This was Kamachame Rinpoche. He was a patriarch of both the Mahamudra and the Dzogchen tradition, so spoke with tremendous authority for both, and had a close connection with the fifth Dalai Lama. So I think we can say he speaks with some authority. Kamachame Rinpoche, I'm going to get to this question very soon, he commented that if we compare these two traditions, the Mahamudra and the Dzogchen, and ask, well, how do they overlap? What's the difference? What's the commonality? What he said was that Mahamudra, which is all about realizing Rigpa, the whole domain of practice, the view, meditation, way of life of Mahamudra, is equivalent to the textured phase of Dzogchen. Different terminology, phrasing, bit of difference in methodology is bound to be the case. Each lama, as they say, lama re le le chur re re, every lama has his own dharma. Lumba re le le get re re, every valley has its own dialect. Okay? So clearly there'll be some variations, but the essence of it, Mahamudra is equivalent, he said, to the textured phase of Dzogchen. Now in the new translation schools, the Gagyu, Sakya, Gelupa, there is no Dzogchen. That's not there. Not as such. That's Nyingma. That's Dzogchen. It's uniquely Dzogchen. So the type of transformations that need to take place and do take place in the new translation schools, by way of stage of completion practice, with the elaborate visualization, sometimes breathing exercises, mantra, all that, the dumo and so forth, which is there as a necessary complement to the Mahamudra. If you want to go all the way to the end of the culmination of the path to enlightenment, then you have the Mahamudra and you have the six yogas Naropa. And then those two, like hand and glove, one is wisdom, one is method. And that's a complete system. The Gelupas have it. Goisamaja is a complete system. Kalachakra is a complete system. And many others are a complete system. They have everything necessary. Stage regeneration, completion, it's all there. In the Gagyu tradition, there's the Mahamudra and the six yogas. That's a complete system. That'll take you all the way there. But if you have only Mahamudra and then not the six yogas, then something's missing. In the Dzogchen tradition, you certainly may, by all means, big invitation to practice stage regeneration and completion, but according to Dujum Lingpa, that's not imperative. What is imperative, and you know this by now, samatha and vipassana, then when you're in the Vajrayana realm, textured is imperative. But for the vast majority of practitioners, the textured will lead you to realization of Rigpa, but it will not fully draw forth all of the qualities of Buddha mind. For that you have Turkel. So Turkel does everything that's done in the new translation schools by way of stage of completion, and stage of generation for that matter. Well, that's all taken care of. And Dujun Nimba elaborated that point extensively, how it's all included in the realization of Rigpa and drawing forth. There was no way to interpret it other way. He said, this is sufficient. So having said that, go back to teachings of Padmasambhava in the natural liberation. This was an earth dharma discovered in, what was it? Fairly early. I've forgotten right now what century. Several, quite a few centuries back. 15th century maybe? Can't remember. But by Kamalingpa, a earth treasure left secreted there by Padmasambhava, out it is. Here's the whole path. Six yogas. Right towards the beginning of this, as Padmasambhava now is laying out a path, going through its stages, culminating in rainbow body. very early on in the text, he says, in fact, on the shamatha, in the shamatha presentation, very early, right after the preliminary practices, shamatha immediately. And he says, do it until you achieve it. And in that section, he said, there are two traditions. One tradition really goes to focus on the view or theory, dala in Tibetan, view or theory, same. First, having established the view, then they go to meditation, the meditative state, he called it. So there's some who do that. Now, if we just bring this into the 21st century, this is what a lot of people do. The really serious practitioners, the really serious ones. And that is, I mean, people are absolutely dedicated to really have renunciation. So, the approach there is, if you're a Nyingmapa, and you're really serious, and you're a man, and I hope women now have this chance, I don't know. Do women have the chance to become Kenpo nowadays? Still not, I don't know. They can become Geshe, and now there's one woman Geshe at least. I've heard, just recently. One is finished the whole, in the Gelupa tradition, became Geshe. About time, good. But in the Nyingma tradition, it's Kempo, by and large, it's patriarchal. But you study for 10, 15 years, and you get lots of study, you receive lots of teaching, Sutrayana, Vajrayana, Dzogchen, the whole shebang. You get it. That's called establishing the view. Then you really are a good Nyingmapa Kempo, and you can talk for a long, long time about the nine yanas and the three different classes or divisions of Dzogchen teachings, and all different. And then, when you finish that, then, if you actually have renunciation, then you go off and you achieve shamatha. And put the whole thing into practice. Right? So that's one way. The Lupa tradition, the same. And the Sakya tradition, the Gagyupa tradition. They say they have these monastic colleges all over the place. In Dehradun, in Missouri, in Dharamsala, in Bailukupi, in Mysore, and so forth. And then in Tibet also. You know? So you go off in the Gelupa tradition, 15, 20 years, become Geshe. Do a whole lot of memorization, debating, ritual, puja, discursive meditation, lots and lots and lots of discursive meditation. And then when you finish, get your Geshe degree, then maybe you go off and achieve shamatha. Maybe. Maybe not. So that's the view first. And maybe you get around to the meditation. Maybe not. Right? Padmasambhava says there's that view where you do the view first and then meditation second. Right? And then he said there's the other way, which is establishing the meditative state first, and then the view comes out of that. He said that latter way, that's my way. It's radically experiential to go right into ascertaining your substrate consciousness. Actually, getting to know the nature of your vehicle, taking mind as the path. This is the path. It makes so much sense. You know? That if you're going to go from here to there, and there is enlightenment, you might want to check out your vehicle first. And it's before you hop into the Hinayana, or the Shravakayana, or the Bodhisattvayana, or the this yana or that yana. It's kind of like, who's getting into the yana? Who's the passenger? The passenger is your mind. Right? That's your yana-yana. Your inner yana is your mind, the vehicle. So it kind of makes sense to get to know that, and as all the great teachers, including Penjan Rinpoche, said, achieve shamatha by way of this method, and you come to know the essential nature of your mind. And then you go into vipassana. So this is what he's saying here, that there are some who will establish meditation on the basis of you, and this is not foolish. If you thought I was ridiculing the Gelupa, the Gagyut Nyingma, and so forth, I wasn't. So many of our teachers, Geshe Rabten, 24 years of mastering the view, and doing it sublimely, and then 6 years of intensive meditation. The previous incarnation, the first really inspiring book of a teacher, of a Lama that I ever read, was Lama Anagarika of Govinda's account of his teacher. And that was Tsongpa Geshe Rinpoche. He became a Geshe. He finished the whole Gelupa training. And then he went off for 12 years. Up way up in the mountains. Disappeared. Everybody thought he died. He just went into a cave. Nobody even knew how he lived on food. He might have been living on julen. The flower pills, until after 12 years of just gone, some shepherd, cowherder, yak herder, lost one of his flock and was way up in the highlands and looking for his lost livestock. And he heard this damaru. It freaked him out. Like, what in the heck is that? There's nobody here. There must be a demon. He really thought, demons are like, for us, dogs and cats. I mean, they're everywhere. And so, see, he hid behind. I'm drawing from a 40-year memory, 40-year-old memory. So it's a bit fuzzy. Forgive me. But he freaked out. There's no way this would be a human being. Nobody lives up here. And so he crept behind a rock, and then he kept a little bit closer. Who's making that noise? And saw there was Dorma Geshe Rinpoche. And so then he thought, oh, it's not a demon. Then it must be a great lama. So then he went up, offered prostration, and said, please come down. Please teach us down in the valley. That was the end of his retreat. So then he came down and spent the rest of his time teaching. So there are so many cases of people who have done sublimely well, having done first Kempo, first Geshe, and then they go for it. Because through all of that training, if they're really approaching it with deep faith, intelligent, integrating as much as they can through the course of that training, by the time they come out, they're just so fully laden with insight and understanding the big picture. The mind is so vast. And anything that comes up, they're just drawing on a treasury of knowledge that they can apply in every circumstance. It's fantastic. So that's the rationale for what is mainstream in traditional Buddhist culture, like in Nepal, India, and so forth, where there are a lot of Buddhists. Of course, many people never get around to the meditation, in which case it's like spending 12 years in the kitchen and never sitting down to eat. Now, Padmasambhava is commenting, now there's another way, and that's just going right for the meditation. Right for the meditation, you achieve shamatha, and then out of shamatha, then let it evolve from the inside out. Establish a view based upon the meditation, rather than going for the meditation based upon the view. Okay? Now that's very hands-on. That's very hands-on. When we find a person like, Tehor Kyopen Rinpoche, like that one, he'd received so many teachings, or Genchamba Wondu, he didn't finish the Geshe, he didn't care about that, but he finished the basic teachings on Prajnaparamita, in middle way, of course, the more basic teachings. And then as soon as he finished that, and pramana, Buddhist epistemology, he finished that, he said, that's enough. That's enough. I don't really need the Abhidhamma, and I don't need all the fine-tuning about Vinaya. I'll be good. And phew, he was gone, you know. But without 12 or 15 years of training, then he was, you know, he's cruising. Because he has so much knowledge that he doesn't need to be handheld step by step by step. He's got so much knowledge, he can go and go and go and go. That's what Toma Geshe Rinpoche did. So many of the great Kempos and Geshes of the past, they've got so much knowledge, they don't need to have really close guidance. On the other hand, there's individuals like Milarepa, who never became a Kempo, never even became a monk, or got around to disrobing as a monk. but he had that careful guidance after going through all the purification. Then he had that careful guidance. And so if you're following the route of really going to meditation first and letting the view emerge out of that, then having somebody there where you can touch base, touch base, touch base, that's really helpful. You may not develop elaborate, vast knowledge and erudition, but you'll get enough. So even though it's a bit late, I want to tell one short story from my Kyabchi Tijan Rinpoche. I always hesitate to call him the junior tutor because there was nothing junior about him at all. But he was great master. He was everything. He was an incredible scholar, great contemplative, and an embodiment of bodhicitta. And I'm not exaggerating. And so I had the privilege of speaking with him once, a long time ago, one-on-one. I don't even know what the context was or the question was. But he told me there are three ways, three paths. We'll come back to where we began, to the path. He said three paths. And he gave an analogy. It's my favorite analogy too. It's eating. Dharma's eating, right? It's getting nutrition. And he said, you know, if you're really hungry, there are three ways to satisfy your hunger. One is somebody gives you like a Tibetan picnic. You ever been on a Tibetan picnic? All kinds of different goodies. You have the shamomo and the shapakleb and you have the tupa and you have this and a bunch of things. Nice big variety. So you get a little munch of everything. Big meal. Like lots of different variety. So you really kind of taste, this is the whole, in one picnic, you can pretty much taste the whole of Tibetan cuisine. There's not a whole lot to it. You know. One meal will pretty well do it. Rorua, I think so. But then, okay, I've now eaten the whole menu of Tibetan food in one picnic. And it was, and by the time you finish, like, whoa, that was a good meal. I mean, it's pretty good grub, you know, for a 2-star restaurant. It's a really good restaurant. So there we are. So that's one way to get full. Nice big meal, lots of variety. Right? Then another one. Somebody says, well, okay, we don't have a whole banquet, not a whole picnic, but here's your momo. Here's a little bit of cabbage. Here's some nice buttery, salty tea. Chow down. What do you do? And you've finished. And you, by the time you're finished, you're full. That's a good meal. Rub-a-dub-dub. You know? And then, with the same hunger, somebody says, here's a nice bodhicamba. Here's your Tibetan tea. Here's your Tibetan tea. Go for it. Make your own bak. Put in the Tibetan tea. Make your little... So you chow down on parched barley meal. If you've ever eaten samba or bak, it's very filling. It's kind of like eating tasty mud. I mean, it fills you up real quickly. You know? Right? I mean, it really fills you up. Boy, but you have a bowl full of samba and you just don't want anything afterwards. You know, it's like, this is going to take some while. You feel like a boa scripture. They just swallowed a sheep. You know. Oh. But it fills you up, and it's actually very nourishing, full of vitamin B. It's got a lot of protein in it. And you get your fat. You need fat. You get that from the Tibetan tea. So it's a full meal. So he gave these three analogies, the full-fledged picnic, the nice little rounded meal, one serving, one course, and then a bowl full of samba. But either way, you're full. You got a good meal, and you're no longer hungry. And he said, similarly, there are those who, as they seek, follow path of Dharma, they become yeshes, they become kempos, they get the full course. They study all the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma and the four classes of Tantra and the nine vehicles and this and that, and they develop this kind of vast knowledge. And then having gotten that, then they put it into practice like Tsongkhapa, like Sakyat Pension, like Gampopa, like Longchenpa, put it into practice, achieve enlightenment. Other people will get just more core teachings, like teaching on the Bodhicaryavatara, the Lamrim, some core empowerments, teachings in state regeneration completion, or maybe Dzogchen, just the core. But really, it's fleshed out a bit. You know, you really get some text, and you get the whole picture, and you go, wow. And other ones may, and they, that's enough. That's enough. You get the core teaching, it's enough. You get the same enlightenment as the one with greater erudition, just in a bit more trimmed down way. And another person, maybe not get any big textual teachings at all, but gets the menga, the practical instructions from the teacher. And that teacher is there, you consult with him, you go off. Optimally, the teacher gives what is called nyongti. The shitti, where the teacher simply gives an explanation based upon learning. And then there's nyamti, where the teacher, whether or not having great experience, teaches you spoonful by spoonful. Gives you some teaching, go practice it. Okay, come back. Okay, now you get the bit next. So it's together with you. Together with you. And the best one is nyongti, where the teacher has experience. If it's shamatha, has experienced shamatha. Emptiness, realized emptiness. And gives you the teaching until you have come to the same realization. Step by step. Step by step. So for that one, you want a very accomplished teacher and you want one who will be on hand so you can engage all the way through. You don't need any great elaboration. You don't need a bunch of texts. You need a teacher who can guide you step by step right to the culmination. So he said, like the three meals, so there are these three approaches to Dharma. All of them lead to the same culmination. But they are suitable for people of different disposition. So there we are. Does that answer the question? Okay. Good. We won't keep our cooks waiting any longer. Enjoy your meal. See you tomorrow morning.